Hello, listeners. I'm Samantha Walters with Below the Radar, a knowledge democracy podcast. Below the Radar is recorded on the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. On this episode of Below the Radar, I'm joined by Patrick Blencarn and Milton Lim, interdisciplinary artists and co-creators of Asses Masses, a participatory video game performance that follows the epic journey of a group of unemployed donkeys. The show recently wrapped up a run at Vancouver's Push International Performing Arts Festival. Enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome back to Below the Radar. Today we're joined by two special guests, Milton Lim and Patrick Blencarn. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Before we get into it, could you both introduce yourselves a bit?
Yeah. Milton, who are you?
My name is Milton Lim. My pronouns are he, him. I'm an artist based in Vancouver, BC.
And my name is Patrick Blencarn, and I also use he, him pronouns. And I am, it's complicated, but I'm based in Vancouver, BC, but I'm spending a lot of time in Los Angeles, thanks to my girlfriend who lives there.
Cool. Yeah, so we're recording this in the middle of the 2024 Push International Performing Arts Festival. Bit of a mouthful, where your show Asses Masses is showing. And I just watched it this past weekend.
Did you love it?
I loved it. It was a really... Imagine if I was like, I hated it. And now
so that was a high five
it.
For those who...
Yeah. So for people who might not know what Asses Masses is, like, what is the show and how did it all come to being?
First of all, what it is. In a nutshell, Asses Masses is a custom-made video game that Milton and I and a team of artists from around the world have spent many years building. It is a game that is played and designed to be played inside of a theater by a live public from beginning to end. It takes about 7.5 hours, give or take the skill and or interests of the audience when it is performed. And really at the heart of it is this collaborative journey that the audience is to go on across these 10 episodes following the epic adventures of an unemployed herd of donkeys. And
those donkeys are trying to get their jobs back amidst a massive industrialization in their region. There are machines that they are revolting against, asking the humans that they can maybe have their jobs back. And in doing so, we have an ensemble-based story with a herd of donkeys, as much as we also have, as Patrick mentioned, it's a video game played by the audience, but one person at a time. And so there's one controller and people self-elect, or they are told to go up one person at a time by other people in the audience to try and navigate, I guess, tropes of leadership as they go through the story and they see their journey reflected both in the room and in the game.
And so the reason, you know, how did we come up with the idea of putting a video game on stage and saying, hey, behold, this is actually performance. And, you know, we want people to engage with the experience as a form of performance and also understand how performance can be transformed by the incorporation, or rather the invitation of other art forms onto the stage. We have a past of making other games, but also like yourself, Sam, we were artists who had some formative training in some capacity at Simon Fraser University, where collective creation and devised methods were held as a, you know, a high value for theater creators. And I think for a lot of us who work in that tradition, the idea of play, the centralization of play within an artistic practice and process is incredibly, incredibly important. It creates a sense of liveness. It creates a sense of, you know, contingency that, you know, we all have to be here. We were there the night that something special happened. And in the way that, you know, when you see big sporting events, I've often, you know, described parts of Asses Masses like, we don't know how long it's going to take, just in the same way that when you are watching like a boxing match, you know, is the person going to go down in the first round? Are they going to go down in the 10th round? And, you know, trying to cultivate through play, through game structures, a sense of really the precarity, I guess, of, and the, I'm going to say like radical contingency of being together as a group, doing something. A lot of the theater that we've seen in Canada, and I'd say internationally too, that has tried to start engaging with gamification, game logic, game, like the world and culture of games. Because of the way that they're importing it into theater culture, they tend to be clipping its wings to a certain extent. You know, we see game aesthetics being recreated, but we don't actually see the principles that really define and shape games being allowed to play out fully on stage. And so that has you know, ramifications on some of the traditions that we associate with theater. Are the lights on or are they off? Are the, you know, how long is it, you know, 2 hours? What are these sort of standard tropes that we tend to experience? And we found that if you let games come into the theater and be a game fully, well, maybe the show is going to be a little bit longer than, you know, your average three-act play, or maybe, you know, we have to sort of have other ways of negotiating rhythm and pace. You know, can we take breaks? How long are they? Well, who decides? Should you be told how long to take a break in the middle of a game of Monopoly or Settlers of Catan? Like, or do you, is it, you know, something that you negotiate with your peers? So as you saw in Asses Masses, all of the intermissions are self-organized by the audience. Again, coming back to this idea of, you know, this is, we're not here to tell you how to do this. We're here to create the context for you to carpe diem and seize the moment.
So that's the nutshell of what the show is, right?
Yeah. In a nutshell, yeah.
Yeah, just like all those things, but also like of our practice and of culture capital. And so talking about culture capital a little bit, which is the trading card game that Patrick and I made, like a lot of the ideas that we have around performance follow through from that into Asses Masses, into what the show is. And so this idea of like, what does it mean to participate in something? What is the context in which we play things? Patrick and I will often talk about how putting any game on stage is one approach to making games as performance, but also situating it very particularly in a specific context will allow the game to speak in a different way, will allow it to land in a different way. And so when we talk about Asses Masses and this idea of like taking responsibility for one another to be in a room in which I have to self-elect to become a leader, in a room where we often talk about theater as a site of political gathering, we think that a video game in particular, and the politics, as what we say often, the politics of the basement, where we all share the controller, we take turns, someone has to go get snacks. When we take a break and we want to start again, like someone else has to go out and say, hey, we're starting. All of those things are politically ripe for us in how we imagine the game space, but also the space of theater. Mostly because we reflect upon in Culture Capital the amount of times we've gone and traveled to other locations. And in doing so, we learned that a lot of people are saying that their work is doing one thing, and yet at the same time, it's very much held within a certain perspective of what theater should be. And Patrick and I are very much like, what could theater be, right?
And I think we saw that a lot during the pandemic. There was many moments when we saw artists mourning theater as the ultimate site for gathering. And it's just objectively not true. There's so many other ways that humans get together to share stories and be, you know, in a shared moment of experience. And that, you know, we had started Asses Masses before the pandemic, and it just happened to become very, very relevant and pertinent to the experiences that the global, you know, the world was having. And I think that is, you know, something that we've continued through as the show now has sort of reached its conclusion in its sort of final form, that everywhere we go, we are trying to remind ourselves and, you know, our public that the theater can be a site of gathering, but it is not the only one. And if we want the theater to be returned, I guess you could say, to a certain political or social political cultural significance, particularly in English speaking Canada, then we need to start thinking about how it becomes a site for all these other populations and these conversations that it has hitherto been excluding.
Yeah. Because I mean, often that traditional theatrical gathering feels kind of artificial in a way as well, like you're sitting and you're not supposed to move or speak or do anything. Like often with shows recently, I've got the sense that I wanted to yell during a show, and it was really gratifying to get to yell.
You wanted to yell at the actor and be like, do better,
or? sometimes that but sometimes just kind of like it's there are moments where it's like, this feels like you want us to do something, but actually at the same time we're contained as an audience, and because you've set up clear parameters of like, stay over there.
Yeah, and we had to really grapple with that at the beginning. You know, to flash back to some of the earlier tests of Asses Masses, we used to have the lights off. You know, we were in a theater, and you know, we were thinking, oh well, and there's a cinematic element to it, you know, for those who are listening, I guess to describe Asses Messes in other ways that we do is to say that it is something like a movie marathon or, you know, an epic binge watch with 150 people. And so when we started the project and we were starting to think about the design that the theater need to have, well, we were also, you know, borrowing with the aesthetics that we had from our other experiences. And we realized that, no, actually, those aren't helping us. We actually need the lights to be half lit or, you know, just dim, because you need to be able to see the people next to you. You need to be able to see the other people in the theater so that you can look at each other and have a visual negotiation of, are you going to be the next player or am I, or can I point at you? Or if you turn around and when you have the controller and you try to appeal to the masses behind you, can you see everyone? Well, it's not going to help the work if you can't, and you have like bright lights in your eyes. So there were these small changes that we were just, you know, very simple changes that we could make to the theatrical space towards further encouraging the kind of social and communal interrelations that we, you know, we hope that the show was creating. And I think it is. It is doing that. Yeah.
I would say it's doing that from awesome. My experience. Wicked. Yeah. Well, I really like this phrase you used about basement politics, because I think, like, yeah, this show is operating on a few different levels of the actual story and how it's set up, but also, yeah, just this experience of being in a space with a group of people playing a game together. I mean, I know I've spent a lot of time playing video games with friends for a whole day where you're just yelling at them to do something, and it's like, oh, it's over there, you have to look over there. And so it's very interesting to take that and put it in a theater space. And from my experience on Saturday, it seemed like the audience very easily got into that mode of feeling comfortable yelling and feeling comfortable pointing at things. And some people were jumping up to like go to the person on the controller. And
multiple were jumping up, and then they were getting beat to the controller, yeah, right? And they would have to then negotiate like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I got here first, but actually I don't care, I'm still going to play.
Well, yeah, maybe for anyone listening, it's important to note that many people have come up to us in the past and said, I don't play video games very well, maybe this is not a show for me. And the honest truth is that participating is also sitting there, is also just being attentive to also seeing, maybe you're the one person in the room that saw where that object is, or you know, you memorized what the particular event is, so you can contribute that. And those are just as important, if not sometimes more important, than the person sitting at the front. And for us, that's the gesture towards like political leadership is not something where we should all sit in the back and say, that's your job now. But instead, like, we should all be actively contributing to this person's success in leading us forward. And then at any time, like, saying, maybe it's my turn to lead us. And so, like, as one of the larger gestures of the show, that's one thing that we hope comes out of manifesting this kind of political gathering inside of the theater, where instead of just sitting there as we mentioned, like a kind of very reserved audience member in the dark who doesn't say anything, who just receives. Instead, we can find like a supportive and communal inward looking group that can also move forward as one cohesive herd.
Yeah, and that makes me think of like the history of larger non-Western theater as well, and how it has been a communal kind of thing in the past. Or even like the famous example of like Shakespeare used to, like, people would yell what to do to the characters.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have had audiences that have responded to Asses Masses even like a panto, like an English panto, where, you know, when the villain arrives, everyone in the audience boos, and there's these sort of tropes of responses. And I think it's totally available for that to become the language of the night. You know, we've said in other contexts, Milton, that our goal is not to direct the audience how to behave and self-organize, but we want to create very fertile context where, you know, democracy might take form, or different types of strategies for collaboration. You know, there's one controller, but sometimes two people decide to go and stand at the plinth with the controller and pass it back and forward. Not really sure why. That tends to be young people, like they who are maybe nervous about being there up there alone, and they need some moral support. So they bring a friend. They bring like a deputy minister with them. And
then it ends up taking longer.
Like, it ends up taking longer. It's very inconvenient. Yeah. And then, you know, those two people on Saturday, for example, tell me what you felt.
Well, okay. So
Why did you not?
Why didn't
try
I not go,
to depose them?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That's, oh, spicy. Okay. Yeah, I did not cause a coup. So there's a moment in the game where there's sort of a series of puzzles, like stealth puzzles kind of thing, trying not to get caught, sneaking around, kicking security guards as a donkey. And also some quite graphic factory meat grinder stuff.
Yes.
And I think it was at that point where you're trying to save a donkey from a meat grinder. And these two people were up there. And I think it was that situation where someone came up for moral support. But they were taking turns passing the control back and forth. But they were both doing a really bad job and taking a really long time to do it. And it was getting so frustrating. And I will say I did not feel like I wanted to get up there, mostly because I was like, I don't know if I can do a better job than that, actually. Fair. And that's a metaphor, probably. But
absolutely. Well, we can take a pause for metaphor and let the metaphors
for meaning of that. But that was a moment where I, as sitting in the audience, I could feel the frustration of everyone around me. And it was a great victory when we finally got through that. But the audience for a few minutes was like really sick of those people up there. They were doing their best, I'm sure. But
there might have been someone up there. They started to get tired, actually, visibly tired.
They started giving up.
And they didn't take the cue that maybe it was time to.
But also, no one else offered to help.
No
one else offered to help. Which is maybe a good segue to say, like, we've done the show internationally. We've done the show in multiple places around Canada. And every time we go somewhere, we kind of get the temperature and the culture of the city manifesting a little bit in the performance. And so, you know, to paint in very general kind of broad strokes, in Toronto, when we did the show, there was a lot more kind of, I'm very present, I'm sometimes a little bit aggressive, but they were very loud and very like clear about where they stand on things, about how they might want to vote together. They started creating voting systems in some of the shows.
When they wanted to, the intermissions, which again are self-determined, they would stand up and say, okay, what, 15 minutes, 15, 10 minutes, 10 minutes.
Wow.
Okay, see you in 10 minutes. And then
that's so different.
Someone in the audience actually set like a timer on their phone.
Yep.
Vancouver absolutely did not do
it. It was freeform.
It was freeform. And then when someone wanted to start the button again, it's impossible to do this, you know, just audio, but
well, look at that dance you're doing.
The physicality of the person who would be like looking over their shoulder.
Yeah, very sheepish.
Waiting, very sheepish and being like, well, I think I'm just going to hit start. And you're like, there's 100 people outside. Like, what do you... Okay. I mean, that's what your form of leadership is, just maybe I'm going to push this button and hope that they hear some sounds and come back in.
And it just takes one person in the audience to say, do it. And then they do it.
And then they do it. And you're like, wow, that is how we ended up in such a shitty political situation.
But
so many places.
As we do the show in Vancouver, it was interesting that so many times there would be a little bit more reticent kind of behavior towards leadership. And oftentimes when someone was struggling, you would see the people in the audience going like, you got it, like very supportive
from over here,
but you know, not me, but you got it. And then there were a couple times in the first show when someone would say, who else wants to play? And the audience would go, no, you're good, and just like keep going.
And there's like 80 people behind them. Like the moment on the first show that we had at Push, it was a moment where everyone was cheering, because both of these shows had a moment where people got stuck, like quite stuck. The moment you're describing in the factory. And there was another moment in the sort of southwest part of the mines
where
you have to do a basic jumping sort of sequence using a platformer.
Basic for some people.
Basic for some people. And jump, jump, dash. Come on. But this person, you know, the whole audience was like, you can do it. Cheering, cheering, cheering. And then they got very quiet because they clearly stopped believing that the person could do it. And they couldn't do it. They had to trade off.
Yeah, they did.
Eventually. But it took much longer for them to recognize that they were no longer necessarily serving the moment as they had once.
Yeah.
But I just cut some of the footage from our B-roll from Toronto, and there's an excellent moment in the audience when they're in the same moment with the factory and the button mashing. It was very clear that the person playing couldn't do it. And so we turn around, who else is a great button masher? Is there someone here? Someone else says, me. And they run down, and then they trade off in just like a huge pat on the back saying like, mash. And then he did it the first try. Yeah, it was amazing.
So again, every time is different, but we're seeing similar ways that the game is also, you know, like a kind of social acupuncture showing us, you know, it's pushing these certain types of buttons in different communities. And again, broad strokes about how Vancouverites either do or do not wish to speak to their fellow Vancouverites. And this is a game that, you know, really thrives on, or you become very aware of the fact that you should start talking to people around you. But I also think that kind of meritocracy is not something to take as carte blanche good, right? That, you know, this idea of, oh, there's someone special in the audience who has the special capacity, you know, the hero to sort of swoop in and button mash us out of this problem. You know, it's not a Brad Bird movie. And I think that that is something that I hope that, you know, you don't leave thinking that it is, that that's the solution, right? Sometimes those moments of sitting and struggling with that person, jumping their way out of a mine, creates a whole special kind of narrative of struggle, of capacity, of, you know, who do we feel like, are we here for efficiency or are we here for whatever this other thing is that's emerging? We keep referring to throughout the show, as you may have noted, you're often presented with the options of, do you want to take the long way or the short way? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, here you are, a group of 100 and something plus people, and spending a full afternoon and evening in the theater, very uncommon, and continually you're being asked if you want to spend more time. Do you want to make this longer? And of course, in English, we often use the phrase to spend time like it's a currency. But, you know, other languages, we pass time, or, you know, we experience it differently. And so those often, I think Toronto often went for, they also went for short way. No, they went for long.
Yeah, long. Yeah.
Most people, and that's what's great to see is that, you know, you might have these presuppositions about how, you know, the value of a community, or the community values time. But also, if the show creates a context where people want to stay, they want to pass more time together, spend more time, they realize that that time of being together is valuable, then I think it's also doing a good thing.
It did change as we got better at doing the hospitality bit, because, you know, the show is, it feels long if you are hungry. It feels long if you like really need a break and you haven't really gotten all the sustenance that you need. And so that's something that we've learned over time to get better at. And so now we have like full table of snacks and warm food and dessert now as part of this run. And those are things that we actively try to do so people don't have a reason that they need to leave. And in fact, that like bonus points. And in fact, this run, we can bring it inside the theater and eat while we play. And going back to the basement politics, that kind of makes the whole game. The fact that you can just chill, eat, and then experience this thing, stand up when it's your turn, the kind of divide between the lobby and the theater becomes a lot more blurred.
Yeah. What'd you think of the food?
I was very surprised to get as much food as we did. And I was like, samosas, ice cream, great.
Great. Samosas, ice cream, great. Soup,
yep, that's
great.
All I need. Perfect. Yeah.
But it's true. You know, the politic of inviting someone to something and then to starve themselves for eight hours, like, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. And when we think about the types of political structures that we have in, well, let's just use Canada as an example. You know, we want people to enter into contexts where they can engage with political thought and political action. And, you know, just as a good example, like, our own government is incredibly poorly set up to accommodate, you know, human relationships. People on the west coast of Canada have to fly back to Vancouver from Ottawa every single weekend. They, like, you know, their families fall apart. They can't participate in anything. Like, just thinking about what are the aesthetics that we associate with political gathering and where decisions get made and what we need. And it's not, this isn't just an advocation for, like, you know, get snacks into your,
it solves everything.
Your snacks solve everything. Yeah. But, you know, if we're going to spend the time together, let's make sure that we meet people with where they're going to want to go, which, it, to be honest, is a philosophy that we also use in the game. Of, if you're going to go over the hill, right, you want to see what's over there. Well, we as the game designers better have thought that you might want to do that and be there to meet you. You know, is there going to be something there when you get onto that other side of the hill? Because we want the world to be full, and we want all of your curiosities to be validated and say, like, yes, this is a legitimate use of your curiosity is valid.
Yeah. And that like feeds into the duration aspect so much as well. I think, like, I was thinking while watching the show that if this was a game that I had on my own console and I was playing, like, I'm the kind of person that I'd like to see everything everywhere, explore the whole map, talk to everyone possible. But then I was like, well, if I was up there, I would feel guilty doing that because I'm taking up people's time. And that's also this question of, like, economy of time. And also, even though I wasn't up there, I could imagine the feeling like a performer suddenly when you're up there at the controller, because, like, you are performing, even if it's just
Absolutely. Yeah. Even if you're just button mashing to plow a field. You know, like that there is a real stress that people have told us it's stressful. But if you're listening to this and you're like, I really want to do it, don't worry. Like it's
also fun.
It's also fun.
Yeah.
I will say what felt nice about the Vancouver politics is that people were quite supportive.
Very supportive.
We're all behind this kid that's button mashing right now.
We did have a show in Toronto where a few people decided to read out all of the lines of dialogue, which had never happened like in a show, and perform them. And they put on voices. And there was something interesting that we had never thought of before, which is like it gave a kind of singular reading of the line because all the dialogue in the game is represented through like visual text, text boxes. And so when we're all reading that, we have our own reading voices in our head. We associate like old ass has a particular voice for me versus you, but now it's only this one person's voice. And you know, there were some,
there were musical theater people.
Oh, no.
Some musical theater people, yeah. And then those
long pause.
Yes, there was not everyone was happy about that in the room, but also at the same time, not everyone was willing to like stand up and say please stop very loudly and very clearly to them. But somehow like it kept going through the entire show, and it was one of the most unique shows we've had.
We also didn't have the same kind of, not ferocity, but you know, there's a moment in the factory that's complicated. It's sort of the penultimate section to get out of that factory. And in Buenos Aires, when they failed, like some people were like jumping up and down, yelling and screaming, like, because the person wasn't listening necessarily to them. The people who were yelling actually had the right answer, but you know, they kept not listening. And I think that idea of I'm not being heard, so what are my options? You know, we're literally in a moment right now where it feels like, you know, millions of people around the world feel absolutely ignored by governments who continue to fund and send weapons to Israel. And like, there's so much outcry of why can't you hear us? Like, why, what is it? Like, how many messages do we call? I leave voicemails, I send emails, I go to protests, I go, like, why, what do I do? And, you know, so these micro kind of moments in Asses Masses where you see people similarly feel like they're not being heard by this person at the front. Well, who put that person there? I didn't elect that person, actually. You know, and that's the case in Canada, too. I didn't elect that person, but they happen to be the person who's making these decisions. So how do I respond when it feels like from the get-go I haven't been sort of seen? And that's really a choice made by the person in the position with the power. And so it's been very interesting.
And I also think that we talked about this about our democracy talks that we had for the Push Festival industry series. You know, we're kind of at tension with the 21st century thought that like we all have platforms, that on social media we all have a voice, and the reality being that we all have voices that are quite siloed. And so when we talk about how we can change things, most times people associate like, I just need to put it out there and that'll be enough. And yet that going out there is often just going to our close friends. And we think that like, well, the strength of theater, the thing that we can do inside of theaters is actually gather and maybe see people that we don't necessarily fully agree with, and have that conversation in real time in places where it doesn't become so inflammatory right away. And so, yeah, that's...
Well, and I think Catherine Bourgeois, in one of her talks at the Push Festival last week, had a great moment where she's like, yeah, we've got diversity, but we actually just don't have diversity of opinion. We're largely in agreement with each other. Like we have a moral agreement on many fronts when we all get together at the theater. And because that's like a certain class who goes there, it's a certain culture, certain values of that. As I mean, just to put it on the record that, you know, English Canada is not a place where theater is sought as a context for working through ideas and or forming cultural bonds. Like it is absolutely not a primary context. It is secondary or tertiary, like whatever it is, it's a very specialized special interest. So again, to come back to, you know, okay, well, how can we return that space to be that, you know, means that we also have to be open to this idea of a diverse range of opinions and perspectives on how things should unfold next. And you know, the show that you were at, Sam, that was interesting, we saw that one little group of analysts appear.
That's right.
Again, we keep coming back to this factory. The factory's hard. But this group of analysts jumped up and they tried to analyze all of the puzzle options of how to get out of this situation.
Oh, yeah, there were like four people.
There were four people at the front, and they're all doing, they're like, okay, but if I go left here and I go up there, no, and then I hit the button, and then what if you jump on the thing? And it's like, that was a very funny moment of collective decision making, that but also cut the audience off. right? Like they became this sort of micro council,
a small committee.
A committee was formed.
And again, you're like, yeah, representational politics. Like a committee gets made and you're like, cool, which also is just another way that I stop being heard unless that committee is going to, you know, run through each line and be like, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think?
Because for clarity, they were whispering to each other.
They were not publicly very like fielding responses. Yeah.
Yes. That's interesting. Yeah. That was a funny moment.
It would have been different if they said, I'll take the first four rows, I'll pull them, and then you take the next four rows and go on.
And again, you know, to be honest about, you know, is that an efficient way to solve ostensibly a logic problem? You know, a lot of what Ask Us Masses gets into is a question around the value of delegated labor. And, you know, here we are with you, have been delegated the podcast from AM, next generation taken over. But that is a very central question that we have in the conceit of the show, that we're going to delegate the labor of the performer to the audience to engage with this problematic that we live in, where increasingly different types of labor are being delegated to machines. So we're trying to find a map or trying to map out a territory where this translation of labor is happening in all the types of different ways, and not necessarily put a value judgment on, okay, well, this is good delegation, this is bad delegation. Look at how it sometimes serves us, sometimes doesn't. And then how one person, once they get the power, well, then they hold on to it and they don't delegate it further. Like that, this sort of flow, trying to think about how Ask Us Masses might visibilize a kind of flow of power and or control over a system, or even like inspiration to the people behind you.
Yeah. And that, I think something I noticed, that I'm assuming people's ages here, but most of the folks that went up to use the controller were younger. And there were some older audience members that I don't think any of them went up. And I wonder, with these questions of technology.
There was a blonde gentleman with a donkey shirt.
Yep.
From Australia.
He whipped it off right as soon as he went up to the front.
He went up and amazing. He took off his coat so that everyone could see that he had a shirt with a donkey on the front of it.
That's what I meant by whipped it off.
Yeah, that's what they, so he kept his shirt on. Yes. It was not. It's not that type of show, even though, to be honest, there are moments that are that type of show.
Sure.
And he played one of the sections, so, which is great to see. In Buenos Aires, actually, we had an older woman go up to the controller and was like, I've never played a video game before.
That was also the first person that ever played.
The very first person who ever played wasn't an older person, but they were in their 20s, I'd say.
So old.
And they got the controller, and then they turned around and they said, how does it work?
Yep.
Oh, amazing.
Which to me is both an expression of incredible naivete and incredible bravery to see a spotlight on a controller on an empty stage and think, I'm going to go and touch that thing. And so then someone in the audience yells, press X, because they understand what that object is, and then away we go. And there are still moments where someone ends up with the controller and they are not particularly skilled with it, but something in them called them to service. And I mean, and again, to make a connection to our political realities and other places where, you know, anyone can be a member of parliament, technically speaking, and they don't necessarily have to have the credentials to do that very well.
But something that we're proud of is that the game does elicit for some audience members the generosity to just give over your experience, to share someone your skills of what I can do and what I can do well. And some people are very good at memorizing details and they can use that well. Some people can speak certain languages. That is used at the beginning of the show, especially where like, okay, well, you know that, but I don't. And so the show itself has, I guess, a culture, a kind of generosity for the group. But also in the design of the game, we have, in every episode, different game genres and different game mechanics that we use. And that's a very deliberate thing that we do because not everyone is good at all games. And so at any given moment, someone might have to switch off. And then we also have episode structures, which means that, you know, you come to the end of a narrative arc and that's another opening to hand over the control to someone else.
You change character.
Yeah.
It's another opportunity.
Yeah.
I was playing as this donkey for 20 minutes, but all of a sudden the story is now, you know, repositioned to be from the perspective of this other donkey. Again, if you're feeling like you're in tune with the narrative, you might feel like, oh, I shouldn't continue because I was that donkey and it's now time for someone else to to be this donkey.
Doesn't always happen. Sometimes people don't listen to the group. They kind of feel like it's their turn to play. We don't see as often as we, I think, would like someone saying from the audience, it's my turn. It's often like giving control over. Maybe that's the politics.
Can it be my turn?
Sure. Yeah. But yeah, everyone, Canadians, we're nice. We have the stereotype of being nice, giving someone their time. There's the understanding that as the performer, you don't interrupt their performance. And so all of those things are at tension with the game and doing it in different places, in different contexts, both culturally and also like architecturally. Like we're inside of a theater that comes with different rules. But if we were to do it inside of a cinema, that would be different. If we did it in some sort of like empty art gallery, also different. If we did it in someone's basement, very, very different, right?
Yeah. So to turn to the donkeys. what is it about donkeys as like the chosen vehicle for the show?
They happened to be the subject that I was working on at the end of my graduate studies when at Simon Fraser University. I had done my MFA degree there and was interested in representations of knowledge and was looking at books as an object, as an artifact, and as a kind of a problem. And in one of the works that I was building, came along a donkey character, largely inspired by an image that I found in an Alberto Manguel book, which is called The History of Reading. And it was a woodcut from the 1500s, where a donkey is teaching a group of students. And it was a satirical image to represent the state of education in that era. So I started thinking about, oh, the donkey is an interesting antithesis to the image of knowledge, right? Because it's put in the place of the teacher. But you know, it just takes scratching the surface a little bit to realize that actually that's just a gross misrepresentation of the animal's behavior. And that for largely its entire history, it has been subjected to, you know, being abused as an image or as a symbol as a way to, you know, be a convenient vehicle for criticizing manual laborers, people who we think are stupid. You know, it's sort of infiltrated many Indo-European languages, as well as Semitic languages and other languages around the world, as a form of insult to, you know, someone else. In English, ass, you ass. In Portuguese, burra. Like, you know, it's part of so many of our vocabularies. And so, you know, there was these tests at the beginning of how it might be a character that could help us understand the contemporary situation where it was, where the manual labor was increasingly disappearing from narratives and urban contexts. It was being replaced. They were being replaced by machines. And at one point sort of stumbled on the idea of donkeys who work all day coming home and playing video games. And that was like an initial seed idea. And there was a little test that I had done. And then a residency was granted to me at the Shadbolt. And I invited Milton because we had already started working on Culture Capital. So like he was privy to my weird donkey interests for at least a year.
That was
like, oh, I'm like reading about donkeys. Oh, have you heard there's this like, you know, massacre going on in Asia where donkeys are being slaughtered to produce this particular Chinese medicinal product called Ejiao. And so I was very interested in, you know, this idea that this manual labor was literally now being liquidated to feed the desires of the nouveau riche as a status. And it seemed like, a very strong metaphor, but despite also not being, it's also just a very real situation that a life is being sacrificed because it is more valuable dead than alive, which is the case for all animals that are consumed. So anyways, we started working in that context and we came to this idea of, you know, making games about donkeys, exploring the ways that we could use the ideas that we had in Culture Capital around dramaturgically translating labor or economic relationships into games. So we took the donkeys, the situation that donkeys were living in or trying to live in or trying to survive in, and turned them into games. And at some point in time, it turned into a sort of fantasy epic of Marxist donkeys trying to revolt against the humans. There's a bunch of other steps in there, but do you want to fill anything in?
Well, I'll just say that the documentarian aspect of the donkeys have been moved into a different project now called Arcade Asinus, which we'll one day make when we have time. But that's like a series of different smaller games. But we realized in going back to the theatrical practice, I think that's one of the things that made us realize that the story is the main driver. might help us be able to explore larger questions rather than just like isolated moments of just like learning real facts. We're like, oh, maybe we can start to see it in like larger questions about philosophies, about ways of being, and experiential questions as well that we wouldn't otherwise have if we had something much more broken apart.
Yeah, and especially when trying to say, hey, we're going to engage with the theater, the tradition of theater, and this presumption that, again, theater has the space for these opera, you know, theater, opera, these big stories, these big epics, and that they have some kind of privileged status in the history of storytelling. We're storytellers, tell us the theater artists, all the time. And you're like, cool, but also video games can tell stories. And so if we're going to go into theater, we're going to need to make sure that we bring the biggest, like a story that is too big for most theaters with us. You know, it's going to have a cast of 15. Well, you can't hire 15 actors very easily in Canada. And it's going to have multiple locations. It's going to have robots. It's going to have AI. It's going to have all these things that theater can't necessarily do in the way that it was doing it before, but it can do it this way. It can do it if it lets video games be theater. I think we should also say that the donkeys, we were interested in this idea that for a lot of us, we were laboring all day on computers, and we'd go home, and in our off time, we would then continue playing on exactly the same machine. And that has become a, you know, a globally shared experience through for so many people throughout the pandemic. But for us in, you know, 2018, 2019, when we started, we were really thinking about the, what is the significance of that which is produced through, for example, virtual farming? It's a carrot. It's a virtual carrot. You can't eat it. So what is it? Like, why did you make it? What is it putting into your world? Or what is it feeding? What is the other thing that it's feeding? And again, that sort of was a shared context, imagining these donkeys who had to work all day and might go, you know, if they got time off, would they play with a plow? And starting to blur this idea of work and play and all the ways that we are, you know, being encouraged to both make work a place of play and consider play to be something that should be outside of work, the kind of capitalism structure that has consumed the very idea of time off as a place for self betterment, and, you know, like oh, in your spare time you should like learn something so that you can be more productive and you know, more valuable in this particular economic.
Well, prior to recording, we had talked about Animal Crossing, which is a very funny parallel to a couple of the things, but also like Tom Nook as a character who is like, for context, it's this raccoon, right?
Tanuki.
Thank you, Tanuki, who for the precision, thank you.
Very different.
Yes.
Actually, just to say, Pompoko was very important to the studying in the sort of in the research phase for Asses Masses.
Yeah. Watch it.
Isao Takahata's. Pompoko. Back to Animal Crossing.
So Tom Nook, you know, it tells you like, hey, welcome to my island. Also here, please build your own house. Okay, perfect. Now that you've built your own, and now pay me for building your own house. Now also build other people's houses and pay me for the materials and everything else that you need. Quite a jerk.
The Tom Nook discourse is intense.
It is.
Online.
And then we haven't even touched on the radishes.
Oh my, the stock market. They built a stock market into the game.
And so for anyone like me who actually has never played Animal Crossing and has not been abused by this Senor Nook, that relationship and that sort of transformation of economic relationships have, you know, we see it in all kinds of different contexts. And so that was, as we started Asses Masses, trying to think of like, what was the story, you know, just to have it on the record, something that was very fun in the development of Asses Masses was that at the beginning, they weren't actually protesting to get their jobs back. They were trying to get better work conditions. We decided somewhat early on in the process that it might be more interesting for them to be a little bit more politically compromised, because in terms of this difficult position that I think we're finding ourselves in, where conservatisms and, you know, like our spectrum is totally blurred in terms of who wants what and why, and whose return to more conservative values is politically supported and whose return to conservative and more domestic values is being deemed, you know, in unvaluable or like problematic. So we sort of created this whole religion that these donkeys have around work, that they had been domesticated for 7,000 years. And so how could they remember a time before work? And you see this play out in, you know, one of the characters, Sturdy Ass, who champions that, you know, one day we'll get to go back to the way it used to be. And she, the, you know, her greatest wish is for her child, the foal, to have the opportunity to toil in the fields like she did. And the foal, who has been born, who are the first to be born into their world without work, doesn't know what it is and doesn't understand why she should love it. Like, why should I do that? And all the stories that my mom tells me are, you know, that it's supposed to be this great, great thing, but I don't have any examples actually.
And I don't want it.
And I don't want it.
I just want to play rocks.
I just want to play rocks, or I want to, you know, jump around and play.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we'll tack this on to the end in case people want to avoid spoilers of the show, but we can talk about the story.
Yeah, totally. Let's get into it. Cause you know, I think we can do our best to avoid the big spoilers, whatever those
Which
are.
We all understand what they are,
yes.
Right?
Yeah,
okay.
We'll play a buzzer if you say something where it's like, or maybe we could actually just redact it at the end. So it's just like,
we'll like do beeps.
Just do beeps. Yeah.
Unintelligible conversation.
So this is the end of the part where it's understandable. So yeah, the story. How did you feel at the end?
Yeah, I was not expecting to be so emotionally invested in the donkeys.
Let's not cut that line out.
Yes. We'll keep that for marketing purposes.
And you know, but you're not the only one. The number of people who came to me during the intermissions, because you know, we hang out and we were there to just meet people and talk to them, and said, you know, I actually only thought I was going to stay for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, even though it said you should stay the whole time, they had the gall to tell me that I was only going to stay for 2 hours, but I'm so invested right now and I've actually canceled my other thing today.
And that's something to be said about like the emotional attachment that one has to a character that you've known for like maybe an hour in a show is one thing, but then for anyone who like loves reading books or like they love serialized narratives, or anyone like myself who's played a video game for like 60 hours, and the amount of time I've spent with certain characters, Cloud, Tifa, Aerith, you know, like I can name the list, and my relationship to them is fundamentally different from one that I've known for, they're basically a stranger. And so there's something to be said about a narrative over 7 hours, like you keep going deeper and deeper with those relationships. And that's something that we knew as we were writing the game, that like we had to make something that didn't just have like a side character that just never comes back, but instead this is an ensemble story. It's going to be something that we're going to have B characters become main characters. And that really gave us a lot of fodder to go back and forward on like trying to find other forms of storytelling that usually theater doesn't have space for.
Yeah. I mean, I fully cried over Trusty Ass. Like
at the end of episode one?
Yeah.
Or in eight?
Oh. At end of episode one.
That can be cheap in the first hour.
I was in. Folks. Yeah. Well, because like the entire first episode, you're basically playing as Trusty
Ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you. And you're like.
Yeah.
Suddenly something happens to you. And there's also like the spiritual element of it coming in. It's suddenly very visually and aesthetically different.
Yeah.
And. Like the whole spirituality system I was so into as well, of just like it reminded me a lot of The Good Place, like the TV show.
Yes, you know what? Yeah. So the dramaturg with whom we have worked on this show, Laurel Green,
and co-writer
she loves The Good Place.
Yeah.
And that is one of her examples. You know, I use Plato's Republic
on the same level
as The Good Place.
And then she uses The Good Place, which they all definitely read Plato's Republic. and just thinking about, you know, we're thinking about cycles of regeneration and reincarnation, and which in the story of Ass's Masses, for those listening, is called reassignment, because we've tried to work the word ass into pretty much absolutely every core concept of the show.
Yeah, or and ass related things like butts, bums, you know, whatever you could.
Which this is a sidebar moment to say high art, low brow, or low brow humor, high art.
Yeah, we go low brow, high art, and just like it's for the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that there are judgments historically that have been made against donkeys, namely their ass is a homonym for butt, but also video games have also been subject to a kind of, what do you call it, like a smear campaign for decades.
I'd say it exactly that way.
That, you know, that they were always vulgar of the people, you know, stupid. They would like melt your brain, like these types of stereotypes really were just another way of undermining the, let's say, intellectual capacities of both, you know, of a form to tell stories, to be complicated. I mean, it's math. Like, how could you tell people that it's like it's just straight up math? So I feel like there is a really beautiful parallel. They're very different, but there's a beautiful parallel between the way that video games have been treated in their lifetime and even just maybe games in general since the days of them being, you know, necessary components of military training, like Go, and donkeys, that they also have, you know, these sort of similar generational smear campaigns.
Yeah.
We did have two relatively...
Sorry, the smear campaign pun? I've now just clocked.
Yes. We should put it in somewhere. But we did have two people come to the show, some like fairly older, if I can say it nicely. And so they were standing outside the show and one of them says, "Hey, are you going back in?" And then they went, "No, they're just playing a video game in there." Which was hilarious to me. And you know, we're
meanwhile,
not gonna
Sam's crying in there as though totally devaluing your your aesthetic experience.
Different experiences for sure. We're not gonna win everyone over, but we hope that they'll give it a chance.
So back to the tears. So that happened.
That happened.
What happened next to you?
I mean, there's also like these interludes throughout the game of like the red screen, like pixelation happening. That I mean, it's part of the spirituality system, I'm assuming, but
for sure.
Sometimes doesn't get fully explained, which I'm for. But yeah, with the good place, it was interesting that so you find after these donkeys have died, they're in this place where there's like all these hedonistic things that they could desire that they wouldn't get in their sort of toiling labor lives of like there's like a pit for orgies, if I can include that in the podcast.
For sure, and there is an orgy.
There's drugs. Down. There's like. We didn't get a chance to see the racing thing, I think, on Saturday, but there is something there. Yep. And then they have the choice to reassign themselves back to life and back to potential labor. And that just brought up all of these questions of like, what is the meaning of our existence and how we produce value in society? And also that like, the why I think of The Good Place is because there's that final season where they find themselves in spoilers for The Good Place, they find themselves in the actual good place and it's they get bored of it eventually because it's just good things
and so that is we were very aware of that story and that value like or so that idea of what is the purpose of going on and like what are we going on to do, and in As Is Masses the astral plane is the name of the afterlife. Yes, it's funny. And you find these donkeys occupying what is ostensibly supposed to just be a highway towards, you know, going back to the material world and getting back to work in what work means. And, you know, there's a whole other layer there.
Not the perverted work,
but the good work, which, you know, you'll find out what it is when you come to see it in a future show, whoever's listening. And that, but that moment of, you know, understanding what that world had to be, that took a time for us, because at the beginning we did think it was, you know, freedom. They were free from the trappings of and the sort of the blood, sweat, and toils of, which is not the way that those words normally go, blood, sweat, and tears, but blood, sweat, and toils, let's say, of of their material condition. And then we've slowly as artists also be sort of tried to understand, oh yeah, well, what is that dream of extricating yourself from the shit that you know, we keep falling back into in this world,
especially while others are still in it. Mm-hmm. Right, and so that's one of the larger kind of conversations about like, are we going to leave everyone else behind, or are we going to do this together?
And I think that question of, again, to come back to the way that we've understood video games as escapism, as a world that you escape to, that you go to and you sort of shut off everything else in the world. That was part of our earlier conversations as to what that, you know, what is that space? What is digital space? That afterlife moment that we're talking about is in 3D as opposed to the vast majority of the show, which is in 2D, borrowing aesthetics from Pokemon and that generation. You know, so we wanted to make a world that was beautiful, lush, like, well, it's a desert, so it's not lush, but it's, you know, it's rich in its detail, And it feels like it's teeming with possibilities because we, you know, we're trying to invite this dialogue on, well, we could just stay here. And if we did, what could we, you know, we could run all these races. We got all these things that you could just do for minutes and minutes and minutes and minutes. And yeah, hopefully, I mean, it sounds like that landed for you.
Yeah. And that's making me think that it's interesting that when, at least my experience on Saturday with our group was that when we were in that space, we were like, no, we have to get back to the other space as quickly as possible because the donkeys need our help over
which
there.
Which is great. And, you know, so if you don't feel swayed, maybe, you know, maybe we go back to the writing room and we try to sway people more or we...
To stay in the...
Yeah, but at the same time, we have seen people like arrive and say, let's go. Like, I think the first time we ever played the Astral Plane in a public context, they just ran right down the middle and right out the other end.
Oh. Yeah.
They didn't even touch anything.
And here we are in the back of the theater going, that's like an hour of content.
We programmed all these things.
We did. We like stayed up for days trying to make something work. And then
it was at least 3 weeks of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were just like,
fine.
We don't care. Like, we want to know, we want to save the hurt. We want to get back. We want to get back to work.
And to be clear for everyone listening, like when you see the show, you will not see everything. Yeah. It's not possible.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we, certain people will always ask, you know, could it have been different? Could it have unfolded? You know, did my choices matter? And that is something that has been a really interesting conversation for Milton and I throughout this process, because we're looking at different ways of choices and what you're choosing between. And for us, those matter because a lot of it is about not necessarily creating branches in narrative, but creating the version of the narrative that's here tonight in this theater. So how does this character respond to this other character? Do they use these words or do they use these words? Are they sharp or are they gentle? Are they, you know, so there's a certain amount of flexibility of who the characters even are through that kind of input. And it's not just about saying, I want to go left to this world or right to this other world. And we're going to build, you know, totally different stories, but it's about, here is the story of Ass's Masses. And every time we play Ass's Masses, it's different. But like any great epic poem, you know, it's told differently, but it also arrives at the same like conclusion, right? My example, because it's just my background, is that Odysseus always comes home at the end of the Odyssey. How long he stays on the island, or how many of his comrades get eaten by the Cyclops, you know, that might depend on who's telling it that night. And that was a real way in for me to understand the sort of ways that video games can breathe. That Milton, when you play some of the games that you play and you want to make sure you get a cool haircut or you want to
always
like have,
it's important,
you know, these like very specific things. It's like, right, when you're creating that story, you're able to spend, you know, when you sat down to tell the audience about your journey through, what game is that in again that you do the haircut in?
Fallout.
Like that you would say, look, I'm gonna, before we go on, everybody, you know, if it was a stage show, you would say, and now I'm gonna describe for you the haircut that this character had.
Important.
And you'd go into all these details because it would represent who they and how they were feeling at that, who they were, how they were feeling at the time, like how many days it's been since they shaved or whatever it was. You have that license, but the end of Fallout, you still reach that moment, but it was, the flavor is very, very specifically shaped by your decisions.
Yeah. We took from quite a few other games in terms of like inspiration of what they've done. I will note down Kentucky Route Zero as a very important game that we had played in the development process by Cardboard Computer. And something in the episode one or act one that they do, which is super smart, is dialogue options, but they don't always make a difference. Sometimes they do, and that's something also in our game. Sometimes your dialogue changes are for branches inside the game. Other times it is for explicitly something for us to understand more about the character. So as we were writing, sometimes it became clear to us that we didn't always have to have two different, I guess, story chains, but sometimes we could represent all the things that the character is thinking and represent their perspective, who we're playing as, through the different options that they have in front of them. And there's that conversation of what they say, but then there's also the conversation in the room, like how do we decide what they're going to say? So in Kentucky Route Zero, you can name your dog right at the beginning of the game. And it doesn't really make that big of a difference, but for you, you become so much more attached to this character because you named them. And we also do that inside of Asses Masses.
Yeah, that's a great example of how do you visibilize thought. And so for anyone just, you know, looking for tactics in whatever they're making, those dialogue options, you know, you can't pick all of the options, but you're given the information that this character has 10 responses maybe to this situation. All of them tell us about how their character is, right? They're all valid thoughts. And like us, you know, we're complicated people. Like we get multiple impressions of, oh my God, there's six things I could do. And those paint a version of my way of responding. And just additional information that, you know, in, because even though Asses Masses is 7.5-ish hours, we can't tell everything that we want to tell. Like, it could be so much more. It could be so much longer. So we're also looking for areas to sort of add in additional information to round out characters, for sure.
Yeah, it was funny leaving the show, and then I had the moment where when I play games, I like to go on like the wikis or whatever and like see the different options and like
where did you go?
Well, I didn't know where. I went to the accessibility guide because I was curious, like, oh, there's the zoo versus the circus thing, like, yes. what happens in the zoo, because you've written out the plot basically. And I was also curious, like, are there any other endings? Like, what else could have happened? Or yeah, and it was funny. I had a desire to, like, oh, I wish there was a Reddit forum for this that we could
do
all talk.
Do you want to start it?
It
would be very funny.
Yeah,
too.
The verse, like,
we
for
show. It would not be the first time that Asses Masses was mentioned on Reddit.
Really? Yeah.
Because we did a version of episode 1 and 2 that. We're totally rewritten after, but we did it in a 300-something seat theater in Kelowna in February on the weekend before Canada shut down.
Yeah.
And in 2020, we remember seeing someone had posted the listing for the show with the description of the show. And there was a Reddit comment on it that said, I'm pretty sure this is just art speak for playing video games with your friends.
In your basement, I think is what they said.
I don't think they said the basement.
I thought
they
so.
Just said, well, maybe that's where that whole phrase came from. But it's art. It's fancy art speak for playing video games, because we had a very art speaky way of trying to justify what we were doing at the time. And so, yes, if you go to Reddit and you search it, I think that might still show yeah. up.
And they got it. They understand.
And they understood. They yeah. they called us on it, and you're like, that's absolutely what
like
it is.
You could use that as marketing.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Reddit user so-and-so. Isn't this just art speak for playing video games with your friends?
Yeah.
May or may not.
Like
those
ironic marketing techniques.
Yeah, which like you see on Oatly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
sure.
Yeah. I like that the references in this interview span from like Plato to Oatly.
Sure. Hey, I think whoever's writing the Oatly box, they could have worked with us on Asses Masses. I think they get it.
They're real.
Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about?
Well, we should say that Asses Masses is touring. It is being translated into French starting tomorrow, actually.
Yep.
And it has already been translated into Spanish, where it premiered using that Spanish translation in Buenos Aires, and has toured to Mexico City and Halifax and Toronto and Kingston, as we've mentioned. We have one more show here in Vancouver. This recording will come out much later than that.
But so you missed it.
Possibly before upcoming shows that we're going to have in Bristol, United Kingdom, and Montreal, Quebec. And then we'll also have shows in the near future in Ireland and hopefully other parts of Europe.
Just to place it in time, if you're listening to this, our shows in Bristol and in Montreal will happen in May.
May 2024.
That's right.
So
in case you listen to it in 2028.
And that's the beauty of archives.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the show is constantly evolving, we're always, you know, interested in, like, we keep it open. We like draw a little bit more. We fix a little bit more here. So if you've already seen it once and you find yourselves in those places too, come and find the pixel art that we've updated and or see like new. I think episode 4 might actually be different than what Sam saw by the time we get to May. It'll be just different. So,
yeah. Also, we're pretty friendly people. If you just want to reach out to us, Instagram, find us on the socials. Just let us know if you have any questions. Like, we love chatting about these things. So if this whole conversation really sparked something in you, reach out.
Yeah. You can find us at asses.masses. And I think in the show notes, maybe there'll be links to our respective websites as well, patrickblunkard.com and miltonlim.com.
Yeah. Those will for sure be in the show notes.
Wicked. Love the show notes. It's been so great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for coming in.
And yeah, hopefully we see some of these listeners. Obviously, we don't know what your faces look like at this time, but.
And you don't know what we look like either.
But
Google.
Meetings are still possible.
Yes. Until then, never forget.
Ask power.
Excellent.
Below the Radar is a Knowledge Democracy podcast created by SFU's VanCity Office of Community Engagement. Thanks for listening to our episode with Patrick Blencarn and Milton Lim. Check out our show notes to find out more about Asses Masses, including upcoming performances. If you would like to support our podcast, you can donate at the link in the description below. Your generous donation will help support the podcast's activities and associated public events with SFU's VanCity Office of Community Engagement. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Below the Radar.